That should be done. Yeah, by golly, now I've got a volume. That talked.
Okay. Several last trees in this courthouse.
Several last trees?
Somewhere.
Oh, King, and I'll do the answering.
All right.
Well, let's go back and let's begin at the beginning. That you were. This is August 1974, but your father was Charles Brower.
Right.
And you're now Sadie Neacook.
Right.
How do you say it?
Sadie Neacook.
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 I have to get that.
N-E-A-K-O-K. It's a sort of a silent K sound. Like more of a G, between a G and a K. Neacook.
We English-speaking people have trouble with that.
Mm-hmm.
That particular K sound.
Well, you know, I took German in college, and I never had very much trouble pronouncing. Because it's similar.
The sounds. The mm-hmm. sounds are similar.
Gutter, sort of guttural.
Mary Mob told me that. She said that a German fellow at Nome had learned to speak Eskimo quite easily.
Uh-huh. Well, the sound somehow, but we've got a printed into Eskimo, you know, translations and so forth. But they can't print our language in the United States. It has to go down to Mexico with those little tilde and the sound thing, the alphabet to print. In the Spanish.
You were telling me over our teacup, with the television in the background, so we've come to your office, but over tea you were telling me that your mother had come from Shishmaref.
Yes, her family. Her father was from King Island, and her mother from Shishmaref.
I see.
See, in those days, evidently, they migrated, you know, during the summer months, the people from King Island moved over by way of Nome, and in through there in their big umiak, those big skin boats, looking for better hunting areas. And then evidently my dad, my grandfather on mother's side, moved in with the family and then met up with our mother, I mean the grandmother. And some years back, earlier than that, some of their own relations from King Island and Diomede had wandered off into this area, and they had sent information that there were better hunting grounds up here. So they started migrating up into this northern area. And my mother had four brothers. She was the only girl. She died, you know, at her birth. And she was buried with her mother. But the oldest brother couldn't stand it, so he went and pulled the little girl out of the mother's grave and took care of her.
Is that so?
Right. So, actually, my mother, I can't remember, she says, but this is the way it was when I grew up. My brother was the only one that I had and depended on learning many things that she learned
yes.
today. But her family came up here at the request of some relatives that had come up here earlier. And at that time, they said the only area that was inhabited was at the point, which is about 12 miles from here, a settlement. And there were talks where during the summer months or early fall, whaling season, they used to get these old whaling fleets come up here when baleen was so much in demand for, you know, garment stays.
Yes.
And it was very expensive. And the natives used to sell it, some of their catches. And Dad was in one of those whaling ships in the fall at age 19. He got caught in the ice crush, you know. The ice coming in caught their ship in early fall in October. Near November, when the weather was getting really extremely cold, and they couldn't get it out, the ice froze in, and Dad said he had no more idea where they were when this happened, but later on, I used to press him for information to tell me, well, how in the world did you ever get up here? Well, it's a long story. I wouldn't have been here if I hadn't outfoxed the chief of the Point Hope tribe down there. There were 12 men, he said, on that whaling ship that got caught in the ice, and he was the sole survivor. Was found, the others froze to death or starved to death trying to find ways to come ashore. And Dad said he had no idea what direction or where he was when he must have passed out, just half frozen. And the next thing he says he remembers coming out of that was in a sod house. And a young woman, a young girl, and two of her brothers were in it, and they cared for him. And this was down in Point Hope. So there are two whaling seasons up here. One in April when the whales migrate north, and one latter part of September when the whales begin to migrate south after they have their young. So these old whaling ships knew about it, and the big bowhead whale is the only whale that has the baleen that was worth anything in those days, when before any man-made plastic or corset tapes or those hoop
the hoop skirts,
or the hoop skirts in early days. And Dad said that when the chief of this Point Hope people learned that there was a white man in the village, he was quite aware and said it was taboo to have a white man living in the same community at those times. And he tried to do away with Dad, but he had informers, he said, these young people that brought him in, found him out there seal hunting. They warned him of it, and he outfoxed the chief. And since then they became real great friends. And he'd been moving to the chief's house. And the man's name, Dad said, was Atangara. He's well known.
I've heard of him, yes.
The Atangaraks are all over. You know, they're here too. Dan and Liu Atangarak are here. Some grandsons of this man. Was known to be the chief of Point Hope in those days in 1882.
I see.
Dad was born.
Do you know what he did to outfox him?
Well, he said he had to hide and get away from this area where he was being hunted, and then came behind the man that was ready to shoot him.
I see.
At probably unwarned, he may have been shot, and died. But he did. He outfoxed his chief, and then from there on.
And he became friends with the
chief. From there on, and he was up here. He's only 19.
I'll be darned.
And his interests were finding a suitable area where he could do whaling. You know, he got the people, the natives, interested, and he said this girl, Taktuk, and her brothers brought him up this far with their team, and later he married this girl. Taktuk from Point Hope was his first wife.
I see.
And she had a sister, Apayao, who was equally, you know, younger, but no more than a year apart. So come the next year, Dad said, when the whaling fleet came up, they went through the point. He tells about learning the language and communicating with the people of the north here. And the people that he worked with that learned to trust him, he had talked them into shanghaiing two white men out of that whaling cruise, you know, those whaling ships, and had them taken up inland. And, well, evidently in those days, you couldn't really find some way what happened to your people, because that's it. In those days, people hardly knew about the way of life of the Eskimo, what type of tribe, whether they were hostile or whether they were, you know, you could make friends easily. But according to Dad, he said they were very friendly people.
Yes.
And so the other crews trading with what they had among the natives, well, they came ashore to trade with the natives and ended up missing two people when they were ready to go back. But once the whaling fleet went down, he had these two men brought, and that's the one that I was telling you that I called Uncle Jim. Jim Allen and old Fred Hobson.
I see.
Al Hobson's father.
Yes. And they went inland and hit out.
Well, the natives, he had the natives take them in.
Inland.
Inland. And also later on another man, Tom Gordon, was another one. They did the same darn thing with. And they started this business, you know. First, Dad said, he says, I hate to tell you this, but it probably make me infamous. He says, the boys and I made a home brew out of this molasses, barrels of molasses that came out of the shipwreck, and used to trade, how they started with furs, trading the home brew that they made with furs and stuff. And he said that's how he started the whaling station, the Cape Smythe Whaling and Trading Company.
How about that?
And I don't think it's ever come out anywhere else, but from Dad's own lips, you know, me pressing him, asking him about it.
No, I've never heard it before. I did, well, not in the book.
It's not in the book, but no. He said, it'd probably make me infamous, you know, if I ever told it. But that's how we started, was trading. Mm-hmm. Introducing the homebrew that they made to the native and trading it, you know.
Well, that was pretty clever.
But later on, he said, then he made a stop to it because it was ruining, you know, he was ruining the people. And they didn't have it. But the old people that, when I was a young girl, used to tell about experiences, you know, that they could, you know, even for a cup of this homemade brew, they'd sell their whole wares just to get it. You know, it got that way.
Well, of course, I don't know how it was here in Alaska, but I know in Siberia, people use mushrooms and a number of different things to create a mental state that is involved with thought projection and the magical practices too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was today we're supposed to be scientific, and for a long time, it was considered a superstitious practice. But mm-hmm. today, you know, there's a fellow was down in Mexico, and he worked with the Indian people in Mexico. Have you read any of those books?
I don't believe
Well, this fellow, he's got his master's and PhD in anthropology from the University of California as a result of his work. And he became a student I forget the tribe of Indians, but they use a number of different drugs down there, mostly mezcal, which is actually I think it's a mushroom. Mm. I've forgotten. Well, but it's a little plant, you know, and they use it as a hallucinogenic drug. Mm. But there is a field of research opening up that they're just not sure that what they used to think was superstition has not got some real truth to it, to be able to mentally line up with people in other places of community.
Well, this was known when Dad first came up here. He said he used to be so amazed at the communications, telepathy or whatever it was, that was happening, you know, because there was no religion when he first came up, but there were no missionaries. But the old shaman or the witch doctor, as they called them, yeah, they had ways of communicating into different areas and getting an answer back. And when it was proven, it was true.
Yes.
And Dad said, don't ever doubt your ancestors' power. He used to tell me, you know, if their medicine in those times, he said, was nothing to play around with.
Oh, I believe that.
He was so strong.
Yes.
He learned about it, having lived up here for so many years, being, you know, along with a few of his old friends that he got. He said, I used to ask him, well, how did they work? Well, I'm not about to tell you because I never understood. But it was there, and I never disbelieved it. I never, for once, ridiculed it or made fun of it.
Yes.
Because he said it was so strong. And I said, don't you ever dare doubt that type of power
that real.
That existed in those times, and it could even destroy. You know, I saw this movie, the Africans using those dolls to destroy someone. He said it was almost similar, that some of the acts, if they decided to destroy somebody, take their mind off, or really angered with some activity, unwholesome activity that went on with a certain person, these witch doctors could really ruin a person's life and just make it useless.
Yes, that's so.
Useless.
Yes.
And he said he's seen it. But when the missionaries came, they sort of put a stop to all that and started using the missionaries' way of using teachings, the Bible teachings and so forth. It was wrong, and it was Dad said those that use certain types of charm or whatever power they had was taken away from them and buried. And it had to be on an island, a sandbar, where there was water on both sides. And do you know that after Dad told me about this, after I married Nate, we went way, way back in as far as Colville River. And we didn't have any children then. We had our team, but we just wandered off, just something that I had missed going to school outside.
Yes.
When I married Nate, I could have married one of my classmates or whatever, but somehow when I came back, I missed out on so much that I'd known Nate, you know, when we were growing up, and I'd always liked him. But that's besides, you know, what I'm married to him now, and we've had a great life together. He's never been to one day of school. But I don't point that at him because he knows more than I do.
Yes, I understand.
The type of living that you can have up here that you need. But we were traveling and we were crossing a river when we came across this stick that was sticking out of the sandbar. And Nate started to pull it out. And try as hard as we may, we couldn't pull the darn thing out. And it looked like it was put there by someone, because it was hand-carved, and it had an ivory tip to it. So we dug in further and found a drum, and it was all intact, and it had the face carving, and we brought it home. It was really old, and when we showed it to Dad, he said that was one of the witch doctor's drum that when the missionaries came in. I don't know what museum it's in right now, but Dad used to send all kinds of stuff to the Smithsonian Institute. Some of the artifacts and stuff that he found interesting, you know.
Yes.
And we let Dad have it. We tried very hard not to break it. It was very... The wooden and that area had gotten so where it just about fall apart. If it was dry, but we kept it wet. We kept keeping it wet,
and the skin was still on.
Mm-hmm. The skin was still on it. It had been preserved probably through.
Yes. What was painted? Was it painted on the skin?
No, it was not even painted. There was a handle.
Yes.
You know, a handle where a man could hand. Hold that,
and it was
carved, a face carved, with a certain expression on it. And on this, the stick, we learned, was a tip made of ivory carving and was used to beat on that certain chanting or whatever.
Yes.
That's what Dad told us. That was what it was. But at the time we found it, we didn't think, you know.
Sure.
But he said that was the way they used to do away with.
Did he send that back to Smithsonian?
Smithsonian Institute.
That now. That particular
That's
gem.
Probably there. Yeah. But you know, when I went to Washington, D.C., I thought Smithsonian Institute, I could go in there just one day and look at. But I learned different. It could take you days to find
anything. It must be huge. I haven't been.
It is. It's huge.
I've heard that
it's several buildings.
You can spend weeks and never see it all, practically.
That's true. Because I've been there, you know. I have been to D.C. and I wanted to see some of the work. Just to see my dad, if my dad's name was there on some of those things that he sent in. But I never got around to seeing most. I got so interested, I got sidetracked seeing so many things.
You didn't get to the Eskimo material?
Mm-mm. I never did get there, but I do have a son there that's studying law.
Oh, do
D.C.
you?
Yeah, oh. My oldest boy's there. He's in law school, Antioch School of Law. There.
Well, that's wonderful.
So he's got 2 more years to go.
But you found that on an island in the cold, though.
Right.
It's interesting.
But well, I had no more idea what that thing was. We thought we just found somebody just discarded this thing, you know. But that was the way they used to get rid of some of their charm or their power.
And the missionaries had them get rid of everything.
Right.
Like that.
Mm-hmm.
And told them to bury it on an island.
Well, no, this
or
was their way.
That was their own way.
That was their custom of
disposing of
the powers that they had with those charms or whatever.
I see. And so then the people became Christian. The missionaries came in and...
1898, I believe, or 78, somewhere in there.
98,
I think Dad said.
Your dad had been here quite a while, I think.
Well, 1882, he was up here. He said he'd been up here earlier as a young kid of 16 or 17 with a whaling cruise. But returning back, his family, his brothers and sisters, half of them he'd never known. You know, they were born after he left. But he was born in New York. His family originally came from Holland Dutch.
I see.
And, come in!
Knock,
knock.
Oh, yeah,
no. What, you looking for me?
I'm interrupting.
Up here, we don't even bother with introduction.
Because everybody knows
it. Automatically think that everybody knows each other.
Well, 3,000 people here now.
It's over.
It's amazing.
Over.
Oh, and over that.
Mm.
I got. Well, tell me, I love the story, but we started out earlier, we were saying that this was how your father got his fur trading business going. He came into Point Lay to do something with looking for coal.
He's been all down this coast, even when he came up here. There was the coal mine there in Wainwright. It's right on the surface. In fact, Wainwright is a little over 100 miles from here. The coal is out on the surface, but it's underneath the water too. After a big storm, all you can do down there is take a shovel and sack it.
Huh.
That's how easily you can do it. But in those earlier times, 100 miles was almost like 1,000 miles to us.
Yes.
So we didn't have boats with motors and so forth. Well,
go ahead.
Well,
but in the 1880s, he started the Cape Smyth Whaling and Trading Station with the three fellows.
Cape Smyth in 1882.
And he had the fellows hijacked and taken to...
The year after that, in 1883. And so what Dad said, I told you earlier, what they started with furs. Mm-hmm. And then one of them had to go out and see how much they could sell the furs in those times. My goodness, a silver fox was worth over almost up to $1,000.
Is that so?
Right, before they got the silver fox farms.
Yes.
And a white fox was up to $100 raw, mind you. And the prices are coming real high again. Red fox, a cross fox, and the blue fox was a very rare species. But it isn't actually blue. It's sort of a grayish, soft. Well, there are very few of them up here, the blue fox. But the silver fox, the silver tip fox, was the most expensive in those years. And Dad said they had quite a bit to come back with, you know. But they had to come in with one of the old sailing ships to bring in their supplies and start their station. First, it was near the point where the first original community was up there, at the inhabited area. But they said along the coastline there were a few families that would station themselves on the coastline, but traveled in the wintertime, leaving their summer permanent homes and moving out, just going with their subsistence hunting, only way they could keep alive. There have been stories of whole villages starving to death because of no...
Yes, in 1880s there was
a there. Dad has told all those, about those. And he said it was very pathetic. But after he got the station started and started trading and getting whaling crews started along with these others, then he worked it to where these other men have their stations about at demarcation point.
Yeah, I've been there.
Gordon. Tom Gordon had his station there, and then Jim Allen had his down in Wainwright and wrong in through Point Lay area. They built their frame houses and started with the trading posts. And then later on, when the men were able to make their own and buy their own stores, you know, and trade, Dad got his own up here and named it the Cape Smyth Whaling and Trading. And he said after he separated from that point area, he started, which is about 5 miles down from here, but there, the bluff on the side was too much to, when they started unloading the boat.
Couldn't get the stuff in there.
Mm-hmm. It was too much. So he moved... where the base is now. The first station used to stand there. The old building used to even stand there when I was growing up. But no one lived in that area. And then eventually, Browerville over here is where he stationed.
He finally fixed his permanent station in what is now Browerville.
Yes.
That's where the restaurant is now.
Mm-hmm.
That was his first building?
That was his first building. It's a restaurant there.
Oh, darn.
And I've got some pictures of his first station. I should have shown you. Those pictures. I've got an album of old pictures. But my sister has most of the... she inherited all of having lived with Dad and Mom all her years, you know. They bequeathed her of the house and all their belongings in it. But most of us got divisions from his estate, which...
Well,
but that's... That was in 1945 when he died.
Well, then you grew up here. Yeah, only your mother. Now, by his first his first family.
Yes, this girl and her brothers that found him, you know, he eventually married Tektuk, the girl that found him up on the ice, and he brought her up here. And they had... four.
Two boys and two girls?
Right. And then she died in 1902. And my mom's family had moved up here too. Well, in, when was it? 1898, somewhere around in there. Dr. Jackson, a Presbyterian minister,
yes,
wanted to start a school and built a church, a mission school and placed a missionary doctor, Dr. Marsh. And out of that, there was a Mr. Hawksworth and a Mr. Lopp that came up about the same time. Their interests were to teach, and Mr. Lopps was with the reindeer, the transfer of reindeer, yes, the care of reindeer from that were transported into this area from the Siberian side. Dad said he remembers the five that were brought up here, and they entrusted Dad for the care, two male and three female, and they grew, they multiplied
each year herd.
Into big herds. Well, by the time I was, I was able to remember, my gosh, my dad's herd, our herd, the Brower herd, was up to 5,000 heads.
Is that so?
Right. And each of us kids had a share in those. You know, we had share of heads, reindeer. And then the native store, the native cooperation, had another herd. And it was just about as big. And we still had them. That was their mainstay, you know, when Barrow became permanent, was their government took over in the maintenance and the caring of the reindeer, giving ranges, certain amount of ranges into divided ranges for each herd. There were some down around Nome area and Kivalina. They were much bigger than what we had up here. But in 1940, when the oil, the Navy first started opening up and bringing in for sounding and for oil, you know, the reindeer disappeared. We've never seen them ever since.
Oh, there was a herd driven over to Canada.
Yes.
To Iqaluit, Inuvik area?
Yes, I remember. I was at the University of Alaska.
Well, I wonder if they came
36 or 37.
I wonder if that picked up any of those animals.
I don't. Well, that's a little earlier. Because in 1942,
when
Nate and I had our first son,
yes,
we were out at the herd, at a Brower herd, and it was a thriving herd, along with these two other herds that they had, company herds. But
you don't know what happened to those animals?
We never knew. One summer, you know, they used to let them graze through the summer months while they were having their young. Leave in April and let them be. But they had special marks on the ears. And in the fall, well, come around August and early freeze-up, then the herders would begin to round up all the herds. And then in November, when the ice was thick enough for any animal to go through over this lagoon, this area is nothing but
great lagoons.
Lagoons. And when the ice was thick enough to hold the weight of the herds to cross, they built corrals and started segregating regular corrals with chutes and segregate which herd goes where.
By the earmarking.
Uh-huh. And if a female was being followed by her fawn, that's where it went. That way.
And that's how they were sorted.
Mm-hmm. Because they had marks, special marks on them.
But after in World War II, they just disappeared.
Right. In that area. Well, that was when this base started becoming a permanent place. And there were tractors. Oh, I tell you, in 44, there were 70 Liberty ships out here unloading for that camp.
In 1940?
44.
I see. Well into World War II.
Right. I'd already gotten my girl then. She's born 43. And in 44, Nate and I moved out of our Cape Simpson camp because we heard the Navy was going to come up in that area and start a camp there where the oil seepages were. Dad knew about those oil seepages, and he had them under my mom's name until 1924. But knowing that he could never do anything with it, he turned it over to the naval authorities, the old Coast Guard personnel. There's records of it here, the transfer of the, just turned it over to the government. And then from there on, this was known as PET 4.
Yes.
And from those oil seepages, which is about 65 miles from here, where the oil just seeps out of the ground, using that as the core, the middle, 300-mile radius from that
became the
is PET 4.
I see.
It still is.
Yes.
And
but your dad originally turned it over to
The naval authorities, knowing that he could never process it in his lifetime.
Sadie, tell me, going back, your mother then, well, the four boys by his first wife eventually went to San Diego, you said.
Well, the two girls and the two boys, yes. My dad had a sister, and she never had any children. They lived down in that area somewhere, but Dad bought a ranch with whatever and asked if my aunt and her husband couldn't take care of it, you know.
Yes.
It was in San Diego. And later on, he placed the four kids down there with her. Then he came back up here and married our mother.
I see.
It was in 1904. But in 1902, between 1902 and 3, Dad said he took the kids out there, the older ones, and placed them with his sister. And they ran the farm, you know, went to school.
Yes.
And then came back up here, and he married our mother.
Who was taken from her grave, from her mother's grave.
Yeah.
That's quite a story.
And there's 10 of us. I'm right down, let's see, from hers. There's 5 older than I am. And I'm the 6th. And then there's 3 more. 4 more younger than I am. So actually, you know, when
and how many are living now? Are you all living now?
All but one. The major I was telling you about was in the Army. He was hitting the post down at ADAC when the war broke out. He's the only one that died.
Oh, he did?
Mm-hmm.
He passed away.
Went back and eventually died. Well, let's see. He was born in 1892.
Is that so?
Right. The oldest boy.
I see.
And then the youngest one was born 1898. You've got a record of it. And Tom was born, our oldest out of our mother.
Yes.
He was born in 1904. That's the one over there,
the pastor
that runs the...
Runs the hotel, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so every 2 years, Mary Stotz, who is the wife of the Weatherbureau boy here, she's the youngest one. She only weighed 2 pounds when she was born. Mom raised her with a medicine dropper. She was born in 1929. She's the youngest one. So there's 10 of us out of one mother. Four male and... No, 5 male and 5 female. We're all living.
When did your mother pass away?
1943. We didn't have any doctor. That was when Public Health Service was taking over the hospital. Evidently, there hadn't been any doctors. We didn't have any at the base either. And her condition got so bad that... it was her gallstone.
Oh, yes,
call.
Yes.
And the call for the doctor to come in by a special plane cost over $900 from Kotzebue or Fairbanks. Dr. Gillespie did come up, but it was too late. Mom's condition had deteriorated so bad that they couldn't operate on her. Mm. She died in 43, September. Mm. And then soon after that was, I guess, Dad went through so much strain. And then, too, before that, some 5 years before that, he had slipped and broken one of the discs in his back. He couldn't walk to go see Mom when she was in the hospital. And my sisters and I were the contact point, you know.
Yes.
And he always wanted everything just to be specific when we told him how Mom was. And when she got so bad, he couldn't go there because she couldn't walk in the soft snow or the sand because of that
disc
was wired together.
Yes.
But he did it when Mom first was in the hospital for about a week. He walked over. In fact, we offered to take him on a sled, but he said he'd walk, and just not independent at his age. But he did something to his back and was laid up for about 2 weeks, so he never took the chance again till Mom finally died. And I guess the pressure got too much, and he had a first heart attack in the fall of 43. He was at the store, but luckily there were some people there. And then in 1945, he's talking just like you and I, sitting in his chair, and just people told. Nate and I were up the herd, you know, up the reindeer herd, 1945 in February. And the station over here, the base home, was placing all these contact points with radios and so forth, and they put one where my brother Tom had the reindeer herd. We had a cabin up there, a large cabin. They set up this messages.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. One morning, Sunday morning, Tom was trying to pick up that message and didn't realize what he was writing, and his wife looked over. And I said, "Tom, the message says your dad died last night at 5 o'clock. And Tom put those earmuffs so fast. I started preparation to go in. And there was not much I had to take. And I babysat the kids up there. I wanted to go, but still, there was no sense in my going, because it was so rough.
Yes.
And I had two... the boy and the girl, and we couldn't have traveled in that extreme cold with the two of them.
In February, no. Well, now, you went outside to school in 34. No, you went outside in 28.
I finished 8th grade up here in 1929, in the spring of 1929. Just press it over backwards. And there's no more schooling. So my dad decided I needed to have an eye operation anyway. I was cross-eyed. Mm-hmm. And he took me outside with that too, and then to try my luck in school. Mm-hmm. So he took me out there. We got on an old Canadian boat, and took us 23 days from here by way of the Aleutian Chain. We stopped down Alaska, and there, for the first time, I saw a big freighter. Wow, you couldn't have put your hand over my eyes, you know. And my first time to pick blueberries, this was in September, and it was all over the side of the hill. And I didn't know any better, you know. I had a light tan outfit with a big pocket. I put those blueberries in my pocket, and I was so busy looking. By the time some of the women that were Canadian teachers going back in that boat realized...
what you had done.
Said, "Look at that." And I looked down there. It was the biggest mess you ever want to see.
Big purple stain.
Yeah, well, Dad had said, "Well, bring me back some fresh blueberries, because I know there's a lot of blueberries." And that's how I was trying to take them back home. But there was hardly anything left by the time I got there, because I was just so, first time seeing big, which I thought were really big buildings.
Oh, in Attu, Ada?
No, on Alaska.
In Alaska.
There was an old Russian mission. I still have a picture of it. that stood there, and I can remember when we got into one small cove or a bay, there was dead fish all over. It was salmon.
Yes.
All over the beach.
They had spawned.
Uh-huh. And I can remember just watching the seagulls. So many seagulls.
Drunk on meat.
Mm-hmm. And then when we left there, it took us, let's see, I don't know how many days it did take us. It took us 10 days from here to Unalaska on that. No stopping. And we never saw any. Well, we did see part of the land, but our first stop was the Aleutian chain there. And from there, straight to San Francisco. And you can imagine what that was to me.
You didn't go down through the Inside Passage. Mm-mm. You went over that
big
ocean.
We went through. Well, I used to just, I guess I never knew what seasickness was. Here, the waves, when we were going through the straits, the boat would go down. And then you'd see the water up there, you know. And then we'd come up to the top. You could see everything. Even over to the Siberian side. You could see the land over there.
And then down into the top.
I used to just sit there along with the captain's son, who was about 2 years older than I was, old Walter Peterson. We became real good buddies on that boat. And his father used to, I guess all his boys, he used to have them take turns in running the boat. And in the back of that boat were kennels, you know, containing silver fox. Mm-hmm. For a silver fox farm in Canada.
I see. The breeding stock.
And that was in 1929.
Hmm.
So when we reached San Francisco, it was September, I can remember, it was September 25th, 26th or September. It was in that area anyway. But it took us 23 days from Barrow to San Francisco on that Canadian boat. And getting off on the part, my first time seeing a car, riding in it, first time seeing those buildings, my neck must have been sore for about a week, looking.
Had any of the others been in outside at that
point? Well, my older sister, like Jenny, was out. She went out in 1925. And she was in her last year of nurse's training, become an RN in 1929. So I had a sister, but when we got off in San Francisco, she was going to this nursing school at the hospital, Elder Bates Hospital over in Berkeley, California, across the bay. And the way that you could go back and forth was through ferries, those ferry boats. And I can remember the call that my dad sang after we got placed in that hotel. He was going to call my sister and tell her that we were there. And he said, "Would you like to say hello to your sister?" And he picked up one of those, you know, the kind that used to...
Yes, the two-piece telephone.
Uh-huh. And it was, part of it was hanging on the, with the...
crank on ring, the wall.
Yeah, was there. And I remember talking to my sister, and somehow she was on duty. And says, "Hold the line." And I didn't know what she meant. And I picked up that receiver, and I looked at the wire. So I rolled it up on my finger, and I held on to it.
Oh. You held the line.
So when Dad came through, your sister is on the phone, and she's wondering what's happened to you. Well, she said for me to hold the line, and that was what I was doing. But, you know, the expression of the white people, like dumb Eskimos.
Yeah.
Well, you couldn't help but appear dumb to the people that were civilized coming from an area like that. And you know, I was very conscious of myself. I'd read about these things in our books in school, but I'd never actually seen a cow or an animal or a horse or a train or any moving thing by motor except a boat.
Yes.
And when my first day in school, I had been placed in, I was introduced and was told I was from Alaska. I was an Eskimo. And all the kids used to just look at me, you know. I don't know whether I looked any different, but I looked more like a Spanish, they said, than a full-blooded Eskimo because I had this white blood in me. Well, anyway, I was very shy because my English wasn't up to par, and the teacher didn't really make it any better when he said, "Miss Barr, will you talk like, something like I had a mouthful or something, you know, the way I talk." And it made me more conscious. I asked you, go home and get before the mirror and talk, you know, how my words listen, got records of conversations, and learn.
This is why you have no pronounced accent.
Well,
people,
I had to overcome it. You know, I didn't want that expression. I never ever wanted to hear it after I learned what it was all about. I used to fight back when they'd ask me all these, which I thought were silly questions. Did we live in an ice house, or did we eat nothing but frozen meat? And I think we ate better than they did outside because we had a cook when we were growing up. Al Hobson Sr. was our cook. And, he prepared, he was Irishman, but he prepared food like was fit for a king.
Yes.
But my mom and his wife, Al's wife, Senior's wife, both native, they'd prefer to eat the native way. They didn't want that, what my mom used to call it, dressed up meat, you know, that didn't taste like meat. And
a man on the airplane, when we were coming up here today, he said, "What did the Eskimos do before the white man came in, the white man's food?" And he said, "How did they preserve meat?" So I explained to him about putting meat down in the cache, mm-hmm. and I said, "Some people call it rotten meat, but I said it is not rotten. It is fermented through a certain stage that it becomes edible again, but it's more like maybe cheese. It has mm-hmm. a cheesy quality." Well, he said, "That's what sauerkraut is."
Yeah.
And, you know, he was saying, comparing mm-hmm. certain foods that Europeans prepare.
They say, you know, if a person from outside had to come in here and eat like a native, he'd poison himself in no time. But for many years, the natives up here are used to that same diet, you know, like eating raw meat. But if it tainted, they're cautious of eating it. It has to be either in oil, preserved in oil, or left in an area where it's cool and gotten in that condition overnight with heat, the sun beating down on it. They won't eat any meat that the sun has been beating down on it. They've known that it caused toxic poisonings of some kind. They've learned that. And then with bear meat too, we've been taught for many, many years never to ever eat raw bear meat. And if we wanted to cook it, at least 2 hours until the meat falls apart.
Was that an old Eskimo tradition?
Right. Far back as I can remember. It's handed down because it was known probably the first native long time ago died
from trichinosis.
Or died going crazy. The germ or the whatever that was in the meat got into their bloodstream and
right.
worked into their brain. They knew about that way before the white man ever came up here.
I didn't know that this was a tradition about the bear meat.
Mm.
I know from living at Nome and being at Diomede Island that the meat was put down in cool meat places.
And they never ate it raw. You never seen a native eat raw bear meat. You never have.
Uh-huh.
In my lifetime.
Uh-huh.
It's tradition.
Uh-huh.
You have to cook it well done, or a certain point where it's all
falling apart.
Never eat it rare or
yes,
or fresh out of the freshly killed. Let it cool before you cook it. Well, they knew about these things, you know.
Well, you were 6 years in San Francisco, or four.
Well, actually 5 and a half years. I completed my high school because I had to take the eighth grade over.
I see.
And because they said that I didn't. Well,
the school was different here.
Well, you know, the teachers here, I'll tell you something. I've been with the educational program.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, these BIA teachers are picked for coming into native areas. And they will say that they're going to pick the materials that they feel it'll be up to par in their learning. You know, they created that thing. We've got some very smart kids. Now, if the state had put out the same material that they put to their high school for here, this is where the drawback is. They're bringing in material which is far back.
Below the standards of what the children are able to do.
Right.
I believe that, yes.
And they've created that. Somewhere.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I fought against that thing.
Well,
I said, I did it. The other kids can do it. I went out and I did my bit with my learning out there.
Yes.
And I know these kids are capable of learning.
I have no doubt of it. Absolutely.
We've got some pretty smart kids, but it's the material that's being presented to them that's. And then, too, they made us forget our language, and now they're teaching it back.
Yes.
When I was going to school, we got marked for speaking our language in school ground.
You did.
And if we got more than 5 marks in 1 month, we never got invited to any school activity or programs or parties because we spoke that many words in school or on the school ground. And what we had to do was to go home and teach our parents one English word and its meaning and teach them to speak this language.